Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple-storey basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary-cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Hello, you're listening to the Breaking Ground podcast, produced on behalf of the Ground Forum and Ground Engineering magazine. My name's Steve Hadley. I'm joined by my co-host, Kieran Jennings. Hello.
Hello.
Hope all's well. Today, we have as guest John Hopkins, who's a project manager at Expanded Piling, and my old mucker, John Chick, and he's a former FPS chair like myself and is now the technical leader for geotechnics on the huge Sizewell C project. Welcome to both of you. Really exciting.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, yeah.
Our pleasure. Been looking forward to this one. I've come to you, John Hopkins, first. We've introduced you as a project manager, but there's a lot more strings to your bow than that, and it's through those auspices that really we've got you on here. Can you just sort of tell us a little bit about the other sorts of work that you've been doing?
Yeah, so I think it's the context being I've been fortunate enough through Expanded and at Langer Road to be on a master's program where, you know, 9 or 10 years into the industry or working in the industry, it's not a step back in that it's part-time, so it's on the side, so it's sort of additional work, but it's an opportunity to really grapple and grab a few research questions that I think we all probably naturally generate, don't we, over time in our careers, and you think, oh, I could really... If I had the time, I'd do some literature review and I'd really sort of dig deeper, pardon the pun, but on some of those topics. So for me, as I say, my career path's been a range of design and more recently operational sort of running a project. So with a bit of an engineering background, and as in my head is often in data and software and what we could possibly do with it, looked more recently at the capabilities, the possibilities of what we could do more, what additional insights we could possibly get from a fairly clean and consistent data set, which is the rig logs on the CFA piling. So whether we want to just go into a little bit of detail on kind of what the CFA
Obviously, everybody on this call is quite familiar with what CFA piling is, but appreciate not all of our listeners are. So, yeah, let's start with that. What is a CFA pile? And then we'll come on to the instrumentation side of it.
So
what is a pile, maybe?
Yeah, pile.
How basic we start.
With concrete in it and some reinforcement typically in there as well. But the CFA being the continuous flight auger. So that continuous aspect is really what lends itself to the clean data set that we get. So various other types of pile might involve lots of digs and lots of repeated actions, which means the data in terms of plotting things that the rig is doing and seeing and feeling and experiencing versus depth is a nice consistent plot, generally, if everything's going to plan. So having that depth plot and time often is useful as well, but depth versus many, many, many parameters that the rig needs to monitor in terms of it not going bang, but equally it gives the geotechnical engineer, you know, a lot of insight as to what is happening whilst you're drilling, whilst you're boring that pile. So I think in the context of learning more about the ground, drawing, and then after the job, is something that we sort of after, without, but I'm not sure, we scratch the surface in terms of we verify par lengths from the rig logs. That's good. We look for specific, you know, very significant changes in strata, such as entering the rock. If we're on a rock socket design, that's fairly tangible to anyone. Really, could look at the chart of torque versus depth, and you'd be quite happy to say yes, we've increased torque and we've reduced penetration rate. But as a sort of process across the board, we don't apply any algorithms to any of the data sets. Say a project would be a data set, but a business over the course of a year, to really learn more. And I think it's an interesting sort of gap, really, that we design projects based on a very small amount of information, the SI, and then come the end of the project, as a contractor, we don't actually say to the designer, well, you know, we learned a heck of a lot more about the job. We learned a heck of a lot more that this type of rock in this particular location, well, it falls off like this and it does this, and there's this particular thickness of the weathered band here. We sort of get that information as we go and we kind of learn it, but that's about as far as it goes.
Yeah, I think we're currently, as a business, at a point where we are interrogating that data more to make sure the piles are constructed okay, and to make sure we're being really efficient in terms of minimizing downtime. You know, keeping the rig busy, drilling all day. Why are there gaps in? We've had an hour between one.
Drill, fill, move. Yeah.
Efficiency. But I think that being able to really understand the quality of the pile construction, and where there's also defects, being able to look into the pile construction technique. Have you over rotated on some material, which you would see through slower penetration rates and additional rotations to get to the depth required? Is there enough concrete going in at the appropriate level? I think you do have to be careful though with this data, and I think that's why people are always a little bit nervous around it and sort of sending it on to parties that maybe don't quite understand it, because if you look at the concrete inside of it, for instance, you're kind of coming up with a profile of a CFA pile. So if the listeners can imagine that they're looking at a screen and they're getting a cross section of what a pile should look like, and a CFA pile is always going to be in theory sort of a long rectangular shape when you look at the screen, but there will be bulges when you put in more concrete or less concrete. And sometimes to the untrained eye, that can look very alarming in terms of a reduced cross-sectional area. And actually, that may not be the case, because you could easily have a stem full of concrete, because of where the concrete is measured from in terms of the pump strokes and so on. So you've got to be really careful how you evaluate the information you're looking at, but it is you're absolutely right, really powerful tool, and there's obviously data there that we're not using. So how would you see that going forward in terms of the use of machine learning, and what could we actually do with that
data? So I think there's two arms to the capabilities. I think what you may choose to try and do in real time is the first one. So are we looking to sort of process the information, probably not on the local on site, in that the rig computers aren't kind of Kieran's new Mac in terms of processing power. they're not necessarily. Some of them are on 3G, you know, connections and that sort of thing still. So I don't think but that sense of, if we were to process in real time, and realistically, we're not, truthfully at this stage, I honestly don't feel like we're looking for the computers to find out a whole load more than the operator already knows. I think the operator in the machine And there's a huge amount, for example, when he's hit that band. They know it's weathered, then they know it's hard. They know that. And yet, because the design schedule in front of them is saying, well, you do need to go that extra half metre because it's the schedule, etc., then they are drilling to the toe level and they're overachieving, say, the rock socket. So that might be the first in real-time use case where you look at it and say, well, actually, for the design purposes, the vast majority of the capacity of the piles in the rock socket, 2 meters of decent rock socket is sufficient.
Yeah.
So if we can trim those half meters, 0.75 meters off the piles that are being effectively, over-drilled as far as capacity is concerned.
Yeah.
Then there may be, cost, program, carbon, savings to be had in a specific set of projects that you're looking at with rock sockets. So that's the sort of real time element. I think the second arm is if you then look to create what we might refer to as a big data set. So data that you're not, let's be realistic, you only need probably 100, well, less than that. I'd say they typically throw out 2,500 lines of data, don't they, a CFA rig log.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take many of them before you kind of average Joe. Those of us that are processing this information, typically in Excel, it's sort of beyond the capacity. We're getting, sheets that are going to start blue circling and crashing. And so it's not long before you're into the realms of storing these things in databases in a big data sense to look at wider patterns. So I'm conscious there's a massive number of variables in play, like we've already discussed. Ground from one site to the next is clearly a huge variable. We've got variables such as the rig type, haven't we? If it's a big rig, then it's going to make ground look very different to a small rig working at full capacity.
Yeah.
Challenges that we're aware of.
I was just going to say, your example of the rock socket, what you're saying, you've hit something hard. That must be the rock, unless it's really high up and it could be, an obstruction. Yeah. But probably further down, you're going to have a good idea. It's the rock. You wouldn't necessarily, at this point in time, be able to equate the torque required to get into the rock with the rock strength. Or is that something that you see being possible in the near future?
So let me just understand. So is it a sense of, do we think we're going too far into the rock, finding rock that's too hard, harder than the machine could drill?
Yeah. So can you, for instance, equate the torque to a certain UCS value and therefore feed that back in, shorten the pile because the rock is stronger, so you don't need a 2 meter penetration into that rock. A 1 meter penetration would be okay. Or in the case of a pile in London clay, could you try and examine the drilling resistance and say, well, it wasn't a 100 kPa strength, a sort of a stiff clay, it was actually a hard clay, and therefore the pile could be shorter.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting, definitely within that realm of the big data set, being able to look at it. So on a sort of single site, absolutely. I mean, it would be of great interest to a designer, wouldn't it, if rig logs could genuinely do some of that sort of UCS verification. I often think of sort of design plots that we've all either designed ourselves or seen on projects and thought, man, we've got some hard rock here. Let me just go and check exactly what the rock UCS is. And you go on and there's a rogue result in there that's possibly one of the cores that was had a bit of a fissure in it. And you're thinking, well, I understand that the designer has to use that sort of reduced strength.
Lower bound,
because there's something there. If anything happened further down the line, we're looking at that bottom end. But the massive cluster of results is over there, way over there. So if you got on site in your first week of drilling, had not as reliable as a UCS test in the lab, it's not, but if it proved that actually you'd done drilling on another site with a UCS of 50, whatever it might be, and then you've been drilling here and you're not actually having to take 15 because of this sort of rogue result, you could take the stronger. So I do think Rock and UCS strengths is more tangible than possibly the second example you spoke about, Steve, there, where a lot of the feedback from some interviews and some surveys that we've done for the research is concerns that the rigs nowadays are so powerful that will they see the difference between a stiff and a
Yeah.
A less stiff clay.
Can I just make an observation there? Because I think you're absolutely right in that rigs nowadays are so powerful, you know, compared with the rigs that, you know, at the start of my career, and what is possible with a modern rig. And the other thing that we shouldn't forget, because I believe you're right, that yes, you can use instrumentation to assess a rock strength, for example, but on a site, for instance, from one end of the site to the other end of the site, from that site to one down the road in the same rock type, I'd say that's probably ahead of where we are at the moment, because you also got to look at the teeth, the configuration of the cutting head and the operator and so on. It's a little bit like as I knew we would, we've dived off into a lot of detail. We started out describing what a CFA part was. If I can sort of quickly go back a bit to those who aren't necessarily familiar with how the mechanics of the CFA all work. So the sort of thing we're discussing is similar to the tires on a racing car. A racing car can have the most phenomenal, or any car can have the most phenomenally powerful engine capable of providing an enormous amount of torque. But if the tires aren't up to it, it will just sit still in the driveway spinning its wheels. And it's that sort of, you've got to be able to transfer that traction to the ground. And each rig will do that in a slightly different way. Each cutting head will do it a slightly different way. And I think where most sort of piling professionals tend to spend the first couple of days on a rock site, sort of feeling our way. What's the fingerprint of that particular site? How does the rig behave when you get into that rock? And I think that's when you then go, as John's saying, that's when you can compare that fingerprint with the instrumentation and say, right, it looks like that. So you'll know by the time you get to the other end of the site if you're deep enough or the rock has changed or whatever. But I think being able to do it as a direct mathematical correlation, it'd be fabulous if we could, but I think that's probably a few years away yet. So it would be fantastic when we can.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was thinking is the complications of changing lengths and getting the approvals. I feel like I'm presenting lots of problems here on solutions, but and I think it potentially is a fabulous solution. But it's interesting. I've recently encountered quite a few clients that have become very nervous about changes in pile design, pile layouts, and this is mainly as a consequence of the Building Safety Act. This is not an intended consequence, but because understandably the government wants to get things agreed at an early stage, everything checked, I understand all that, it's led to less flexibility, and we're actually seeing clients, and this actually feeds into the second part of the conversation that we'll be having with John Chick regarding sustainability by design. There's actually become a reluctance to do load testing, and one of the consequences of load testing is to have smaller piles and therefore save money and be better for the environment because you're putting less concrete in the ground. But people now are reluctant to do load testing because they don't want to risk the possibility of a pile test failure and therefore a redesign of the piles and the piling scheme, which I'm sure is a really unintended consequence of the act, but it's a negative one that we should be aware of and think our way around. Maybe we'll come back to that in a moment, because I do, before we want finish the discussion around the instrumentation side of things, I do want to talk, John Hopkins, about your survey. So you sent out a survey to leaders within the pylon industry. But did it go wider than the pylon industry, or was it?
Predominantly part of the pylon industry, in that some people picked it up, putting it out on LinkedIn and places like that, and got halfway through and thought, not necessarily too long, but like not within their area of expertise their experience. So I did get some of my course colleagues and things helping out, being like, I'll do your survey, and then they were like, not exactly got the experience to be of use, but sure, grateful all the while. So yeah, we sort of had about 70 responses within the industry across roles, which range from very much kind of on-site rig operators through to obviously senior people with a long service in the industry and a lot of experience. So it was good. And obviously as a passionate, I'm not sure I can say young anymore, having been around 10 years now, but at this stage in my career, to
you're young, John. You're young.
What and why? I'll obviously, these are the conversations I'll spark up on site, off site, in the pub. People obviously in piling want to talk about piling. That's great. But the opportunity with the research has been like it's a great excuse to jump into people's inboxes or LinkedIn.
So what was the big themes? So, John, what are the big themes that came out of the so if you could summarize those for everybody, that would be amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this particular essay was looking at the feasibility of not just that use case we've sort of discussed earlier, but getting a temperature check, really, on whether people are afraid of AI. It's a buzzword, isn't it, nowadays? Do people genuinely think it's going to impact their role, their day-to-day? Or is it just another, ChatGPT, that's come out. Do people actually think machine learning and algorithms are going to seriously and significantly impact their role and the projects and the designs and the outputs that they actually produce? So I think it's safe to say that they do, that there was a range of kind of 8 use cases, and people's responses range from sort of just under 40% through to sort of just under 90% of participants thinking, yes, these use cases, rock levels was one, broader than sort of drilling data, you're looking at, real-time forecasting, firing lots of inputs into programs, that sort of thing, being more accurate. Not that planners don't know what they're doing, as in they do, but it's that ability to sort of really, really quickly update things like that. Performance, we may well talk about performance, moving on to power load tests and stuff, but certainly overseas, as far as the papers I've been digging into, there's been a lot of work looking at predicting performance using machine learning and algorithms. So, how many tests have we done in the UK? A lot. And from, searching, a lot papers in places like Dubai, where they've done a lot very recently, and I think there's a vested interest, isn't there, in where they're going to do more in the near future as well. They sort of seem to have had a bit more of a collective approach than we might have had, where we've been putting piles in, deep piles in London for a good while, and the rest of the country. So that's very interesting. And then I guess the other space where, if we're talking about drilling, which we are, and the other industry where they've really thrown money at algorithms and machine learning capabilities, is drilling for the black gold and that natural gas. So where they're drilling, thousands of meters, and rate of penetration is such an influential parameter, isn't it? And they're measuring lots of things like weight on bit, all the things John talked about are the sensitivity analysis bits that they're considering. They're measuring whatever they can. So appreciate I've deviated slightly from my topic, but these are the examples of the possibilities and potential use cases in our industry, and the survey really looked to gauge that. And I think as a headline, people think, it's capable, but equally, to caveat, I was really grateful for the sort of comments beyond the choose a number, do you think it's going to work questions, where people would express their you know, reservations and appreciation.
What were the biggest, what were the biggest reservations to the use?
Yeah, I think it would probably fall. One big one, which is very, very common in the space of deep learning, is that sense of an experience versus a machine spitting an answer out. So that sort of black box sense that, are we going to put too much faith in these? Are we going to sort of be more laxed with checks and verification because it spat out a perfectly reasonable looking answer, but we don't know exactly what the learning.
It's funny because
the network has done.
Last night, my colleague Roger, he actually put a caption on one of our group chats, and it was the 10 jobs at lowest risk of being taken by robots. Do you know what came out top? Pile driver operator.
Really?
Yeah. It's just coincidence that came through last night, but I would have thought in a sense that actually, that would be a relatively straightforward one for robots to be able to take over at least an element of it. I mean, you're always going to need people in and around the machine, but you doing stuff remotely and giving more of the responsibility to the machine makes sense. I've looked at piles that we've constructed in the last few weeks, using there's an auto drill, auto fill function, which we've not used wholesale over the last few years that we've had that available to us, but we're starting to realize it makes it a lot easier for everybody involved. It makes it easier for the operator to get it right. It will probably make a better pile. It'll use less concrete where you don't need to be using too much concrete. It will use enough concrete where you might not be putting in sufficient material. And when it comes to sort of validation on the QA side of things, it's a lot more straightforward because these profiles look perfect. So it's saving time in the office in terms of reviewing the instrumentation data.
Bringing up the discussion of AI with particularly on-site staff, operators and supervisors and stuff, they jump straight to that piece, straight to the automation, you know, you're going to take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd really early on try and caveat that we're not trying to do that. Not at this stage and not within your career lifetime, don't worry. So I try and give the opposite selling piece being, you know, we want the machine to help us learn more. You know, ultimately quantify and digest all that knowledge and experience that you've got. And I think people often appreciate or misunderstand the AI as being like entirely trained by a computer. Now, if you have an automated, say, drilling mode for clay, you're going to train that artificial intelligence robot on thousands of rig logs drilled by humans in clay. So those thousands of rig logs are like a brain download of what those operators decided to do with the levers, you know, maybe prior to, as you say, automation. So I'm not trying to pretend it's a hive mind of every single rig operator, but effectively it is, because it's been trained to respond to ground stimulus, and the response is going to be a combination of what all the operators chose to do in that moment. So I think, as you say, automation in its current form is processing information, it's processing what the rig's doing, but it's not making decisions, I don't believe, based on a huge data set of previously drilled piles, is it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not learning as it goes. It's a rule-based algorithm rather than a decision-based one that's based on a vast sort of data set of previous experience.
So this is where you see the next opportunity in terms of collecting data across the industry to improve
quite possibly. As you say, it's those, you could quite easily put PALS into a category of computer would have no problem there. You know, rigs working well within its capabilities, simple strata. I think, you know, many operators would refer to sort of trying to get sockets and trying to keep a pile dry going through the wet with the casing. You know, that's obviously very technical. And I do not want to be the one that says, oh, a computer do it way better than you, mate. Like, it's technical. And it doesn't always happen, does it? Because you get a good operator and sometimes you get one that struggles. So those are additional challenges, aren't they? I think, as I say, it's probably more in the rotary space and we're looking beyond CFA, but it's relevant, I think.
I think there's a there's also a piece at the moment where we are at the moment in the industry where there's instrumentation and there's digitization and automation. And I think there's a degree of the automation at the moment that we can do more of, as opposed to if the listener went and looked in a piling rig, you're looking at probably €1.5 million worth of, you know, the finest German, Italian, Spanish technology, whatever, and you're sitting there and the rig operator has very large windows, but he can't actually see anything. He sees very little. Because he's in front of him is a whole bank of screens that he has, the operator has to watch all of the time to operate that rig safely. So if we can take a degree of automation and take the digitization and put that into the automation, so that the operator isn't having to actually worry about that, but is actually operating the rig rather than necessarily installing the pile, if you see what I mean. Because the rig operator is a very challenging job, particularly when they can't see and they're entirely dependent on the person standing outside, the banksman. And I think that I had various misconceptions about all this until a few years ago when I actually sat in one. I was challenged to sit in one and to bore a pile in a yard. And it is incredibly challenging just to operate the rig rather than necessarily to install the pile. And at the moment the demands are getting greater and greater and greater, and the quicker we can automate things, exactly like Steve's saying with the auto drill, and you say we use auto drill quite frequently, but on rotary, things like knowing where the Kelly is, knowing where the Kelly elements are they in their locks, you know, where are they up and down the pile and so on, doing a pile under bentonite and so on, you know, where are the tremie tubes and that sort of thing, because it extends beyond the rig onto the ground, in terms of the guys on the ground who are then actually filling the pile with concrete. And I think if where we are at the moment, I think the digitization can move into the automation, or is moving into the automation, to go from 5 screens to about 3 or something. I mean, we went on a project a little while ago where a specific requirement of the project was to monitor XYZ. We had to add a screen, and the poor guy was sitting there with 6 screens in front of him. And you think you can't, you can't do it. One or two is fine. And I think this is somewhere that if we're not careful, we'll get more and more clever, but actually forget what we're actually trying to do. And this is why I would like to actually pay a bit of a tribute to John at this point, because what he's been doing on digitization and the digital world, normally, very often, the digital industry and what the digital industry can provide leads what we're able to buy and do. Whereas what John has been prioritizing is what the industry needs is what we need to develop. So it's very much needs-led. And the more that needs-led is taken on, it's being adopted by plant manufacturers and so on as well. And we're seeing more and more rigs now with fewer screens, more automation, more programmable installation packages that you can put in there. And I think that's a great thing to say. I don't think it necessarily does away with the person, but it will certainly do away with a lot of the stress for the person. And they will be concentrating on operating and managing the right thing from their seat. If that makes sense,
I think sort of on the sort of big level, you know, one of the challenges of AI is that it takes out a lot of the legwork. I think if you look in business generally, out of a lot of tasks, and allows the person using it to sort of focus on the sort of maybe 10-15% of a task that actually adds value, because it's about the human decision making and sort of optimization of what you're doing. Now the problem with that I see is one of, you know, we're great to do that right now, because the people using AI have generally had years of experience doing that 85% sort of legwork, and so they know what good looks like. But I think there's a sort of challenge here that the skills in that area, as time goes on, will atrophy because AI's doing it for you, and it's not being sort of questioned. And so, my anxiety, I guess, about it is will people still have the skill to do that sort of 15% value add piece if they haven't had the experience of doing the sort of legwork? So in geotechnical terms, it would be, you know, if you've got AI producing pile designs for you and you've got an experienced geotechnical engineer reviewing those, their experience should be able to sort of tell them whether that design checks out or not, or is appropriate for the challenge. But there's a danger, I guess, in the future that you have geotechnical engineers who haven't had the experience of designing piles themselves, and then they're sort of getting the AI and sort of thinking, well, yeah, that looks probably okay, but actually they don't have the same basis of experience to make that judgment. And I think that's an AI problem everywhere across every industry, potentially, that will have to work out how we sort of almost, you know, inculcate the right skills to do that value add piece, where, you know, where the human really comes into it in a way that I think AI probably can't do. I mean, AI will sort of get further into it, but it won't ever, I think, have quite the same, you know, cognition to do what we do, or what we have to do.
It is an incredible tool. I've been playing around with ChatGPT with the kids, and it's
hugely
phenomenal.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Just, I think,
coming up with stupid things that's just like dogs, yeah,
image
doing
generation
somersaults.
There's crazy stuff. But so I totally agree with your point there, Kieran, and it was certainly one of the major barriers, because one of the sort of interview-based essays that I wrote, so interviewed about 12 people, was certainly that topic of and equally attending a sort of conference at Imperial this year prior to one of the ranking lectures was on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people at the front, but equally the discussions you're having with the people there, there's risk, especially those that have been in the industry longer. I think maybe the new, like the younger people are thinking, yeah, it's going to sort of do all this stuff for us. And older people are very, very reserved. Understandably so. So I think, just to make one point, I think, as you say, there's a bit of a mitigation aspect is, you know, we need to look at almost modularizing and chunking down the steps that we do, that any designer would do and undertake, and looking at the AI, how it can help each individual one. So, you know, plotting of the borehole from the report, very quickly summarizing that. Then maybe going to the AI and going, oh, have we got any others similar? Oh, brilliant, we've got a designer there. So that's something that we couldn't do before and we now can, but very, very specifically in the space of the SI. Then looking at maybe doing some you know, initial calcs. I think the big risk comes, doesn't it, when it's end-to-end. Information in, spits out an entire pile layout, pile schedule, and you're like, okay, yeah, looks reasonable. And you haven't done any of that process yourself. So that's something, but equally it's sort of one of those things that we need to constantly keep an eye on, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. And you only need the first problem to sort of stimulate everybody's...
Yeah.
Thinking on that, I suspect, you know, it will be fine until it isn't.
Let's move the conversation on, shall we, to sustainability by design, which is a topic that really John Chick has been pushing hard throughout his time with the Federation of Piling Specialists, or during his time as chair there. John, can you just explain what the term means and the sort of activities that have been going on around that?
Sure, yeah. It's the for perfectly good reasons, and admirably so across the world. Obviously, you know, sustainability is the essential argument, that, you know, the essential debate that is going on, and how can we have a lesser impact on the planet. And there's an awful lot of thought that's gone into coming up with new and innovative ways of doing things in terms of the so how we do things. But if you look back to what we do as ground engineers, fundamentally, there's what we do can have a make a major difference as well. And I started you start thinking in conversation with various other people, you know, in the industry, and so established geotechnical experts, and people like Dimitrios Simitas at AKT2, and people like say people like Dimitrios have been very helpful in the debate. And one of the simplest ways, I suppose, I could sort of sum this up is, rather than designing something in a more clever way, or rather than use electric, making sure everything is battery powered, or you know, recycling absolutely everything as well, use less. Just start out in the first place. Make your first target use less material, because then there's less material, less base material to be quarried, mined, whatever, processed, transported, and then converted into something else. A person I knew very well, he recently retired, said he'd made a very good living out of blowing rocks out of a quarry, crushing them into tiny little bits, and then selling people to stick it back together. And so if you can do less of that, and I suppose one of the best illustrations would be something like the factor of safety. And there's a couple of things have come in already which are very useful. Your comment about test piles, for example, Steve, and people worried about a test pile failure. And failure is a very, very emotive term that leads directly back to unsustainable designs. So if you take something like a factor of safety of a pile, most of us are pretty familiar with the concept of, you know, if you've got your safe working load of a pile, that safe working load needs to have a factor of safety. And we very often, in simplistically, you'd multiply that by 2 or 2.5 or sometimes even 3 and say, I'm going to design that pile for 2.5 times its safe working load when it's at work under this particular building. And you think, yeah, it's fair enough as far as it goes, but you then find in specifications, you'll find other provisos then get added, which is, I want a factor of safety of 2.5, but at safe working load, its settlement mustn't be more than 8 millimetres, say. At 1.5 times safe working load, its settlement mustn't be more than 15 millimetres, and failure will be 10% of the diameter. Well, if you imagine a load settlement curve, as you increase the load on the pile, then add a bit of load, the pile will settle a bit more, load will settle a bit more. And it's generally a linear relationship until you get to the point where the ground is effectively overstressed and cannot provide the capacity you need. And the pile will start to move. And at that point, if you unloaded it, it wouldn't go back where it came from. It wouldn't come back up. So you've got elastic deflection, then you've got a sort of a plastic area, and then failure. And if you take failure as being the point at which the pile can tolerate no more load and is being pushed straight into the ground, every increment of load is a direct large increment of settlement. Well, that's not 10% of the diameter. So if somebody wants 2.5 times safe working load, but you then say dictate what you want as settlement, safe working load, and 1.5 times and failure is 10% of the diameter, you need to design the pile in reality with a factor of safety of 6 or 7. In some ground conditions, sometimes 8 or 9, depending on the ground. And so that is a very, very unsustainable way of designing a pile. A lot of perhaps clients, perhaps structural engineers, will think to themselves that actually provides safety. And the words safety and failure are very, very emotive. And basically what a client wants, what a customer organization wants, is they just don't want their building to move. But you find this bizarre situation where, and again, as we've already discussed, the ground conditions are very variable. So you go onto a site, and the ground conditions are suitable for a building built on a raft or strip footings or pad foundations. And the designers and the owners, the freeholder, whatever, insurance organizations are quite happy with a settlement of 25 millimeters. Built on pads, 25 millimeters. Next door, the ground conditions are slightly different, and those buildings have to be on piles. All of a sudden, the requirement is for 6 or 7 millimetres.
Same superstructure.
The same building.
Essentially.
Yeah, it's, yeah, exactly the same superstructure. It's just, you know, one is, you know, one's Rose Avenue, the other one's Daffodil Avenue, but one, you know, one has to have a much more stringent settlement criteria than the others. And you start thinking about this, thinking, well, the, you know, the word failure, what actually is failure? Because you tend to think of failure is fairly catastrophic, you know, sort of image in your mind. Whereas in fact, a building that was supposed to settle 8 millimeters that actually goes 10, that's not failure as such, is it? And this was, I mean, even recently on a particular project, there were two test piles carried out by two different companies. Similar depth, same method, different rigs, obviously, because of two different companies on two areas of the site, say two different phases. One had a test pile that was supposed to have, I think it ends up with a 15 or 20 story building on top of it. And one went 1.2 millimeters more at its safe working load than the other one. And all of the talk was around how the first one had failed, and the first pile wasn't as good as the other one. You think, right, hold up, draw two lines 1.2 millimeters apart. And what people then lose sight of is that a high-rise building actually compresses. I mean, so I work for a company who build a lot of high-rise buildings, a lot of concrete structures. And these buildings compress elastically as you build them. So your building might well compress by 20, 25 millimetres by the time you get 20 stories up. And as you put each floor on, you're monitoring not the settlement of the building, but the compression of the concrete between each floor. Well, what cost 1.2 millimeters? Because the pile is also elastic. The material is elastic. And you start putting all these together. And I thought, well, maybe we need to change the codes. Do we need to change the design codes? We don't. I had extensive discussions with insurers and underwriters and so on. They were saying, well, no, you just need to work within the codes responsibly and sensibly. You wrote the codes after all. And I think, okay, yeah, fair point. You got me there. And they're absolutely right, which is that the existing codes do not require us to put multiple layers of protection in. And I'm not advocating under-designing something. I really just want to emphasize that. But if you have a pile that is going back to the concept of a pile as an elastic concrete member in the ground, if you have a pile that's 25 meters long, below about 15 meters, the concrete in that, it doesn't even know that there's a load on it. And any concrete that we're putting in below the working section that is actively resisting that load is effectively waste. And the question becomes, how much do you want to waste? And so we can, yes, and the concrete people like concrete suppliers are putting huge amounts of work into concrete replacements and so on, which is fantastic. Far lower carbon. Did a project recently where we had a very high replacement, very high cement replacement, which ended up with actually a lower carbon count, lower carbon value than a zero carbon concrete. It was largely how you calculate it, but with all the effort that's gone into battery-powered wagons, battery-powered delivery, electric equipment and so on, the carbon cost of the truck driving to the site is vanishingly small compared with the carbon cost of what it's carrying and what you're about to put into your building. And there are some very enlightened developers these days who have twigged this, and they really are driving hard for the lowest carbon solutions. And they've picked up on sustainability by design, because it's not them that are necessarily worried about it. It's their tenants. It's their customers. It's the footfall through the door of, you know, chains of businesses, for example, who don't care, and those who do. And those who do get a higher footfall. And so this sustainability by design is really, you know, look at the loads you are designing for. So taking a piled foundation, for instance, to a settlement rather than necessarily to a factor of safety. Yes, use the lowest carbon products that you can use, and then you effectively get double bubble, because you're using less of something that's got far less carbon, and deliver it using a battery powered truck. But you're immediately defeating your own good intentions by refusing to budge on how much you're actually using. Live loads, for example, are way overstated. If dead loads, more or less, yeah, because you can work out how much a building weighs. But live loads are generally vastly overstated. I know you could probably find it online, or you probably Google the images. But Demetrius gave a talk some while back. It was a very amusing series of slides that showed the what a live load of 30 kilonewtons a meter squared would look like in people terms.
There's about
50 people crammed into this tiny little square.
And, said, and you factor it up as well, don't you, in the design?
And you factor it up. And so I think that trying to question what we do, and also interpreting test pile results properly, you raise an interesting point, because of the words failure, failure, settlement, things like that. And safety, factor of safety. I mean, I've got a bit of a campaign. I would love one of these days for FOS to stand for factor of settlement rather than factor of safety. And it's trying to get people's thinking away from this catastrophic sense, because exactly as you said, Steve, you'll find a project which has got enough piles on there for a concurrent non-working test pile to shorten the piles on the rest of the job. So you say, we're going to spend the first 2 weeks of the job, we'll be piling effectively at risk. We'll put them in, and the piles are going to be 24 metres long, but we think they could be 22 metres long if we get a good result from a non-working test pile. We come up with a result, and the client says, yeah, very good, thanks. That just means all the others are going to be even more safe, so no, you can't shorten them. And you think that's a difficult argument. That's a very difficult argument. Because that's around risk, the commercial perception, or the perception of risk from that point of view. Interestingly, other things, if you take noise, for example, noise comes from the people expending energy. Noise doesn't just happen. There has to be an energy source. And something we did learn during... it was actually during COVID, when construction carried on, and we were on various sensitive sites, because we all work on sensitive sites, surrounded by neighbours who were all at home. And they were all annoyed by the noise. So we were trying to find ways to reduce noise. And we were finding things like, it's very difficult to silence a Kelly bar, for example, but things like noise screens, battery-powered equipment as opposed to diesel, whether that be generators, water bowsers, concrete saws, whatever, limiting the amount of cutting we were doing, which meant get stuff delivered to site that's the right length, because it's been cut in a factory. Don't bring it to site and then have somebody with a steel saw go and cut it. And then you think, well, hang on, that's less fuel, and it's also less carbon, because I haven't got any waste. So I'm using less. Again, I'm not delivering a bulk material to get a bulk quantity to get a net quantity. And we found sites generally got quieter. So we still struggle with rotary ball piles and Kelly noise. But again, in terms of engine off technology, a lot of rigs previously, you couldn't turn them off because the instrumentation would forget what it was doing. Effectively, it would just go down. And when you turn it back on again, you'd start all over again. Whereas now, say, speaking to the designers of the rigs, you can say, right, now you've got rigs where you can actually turn them off. So rig design, your rigs are now coming out as being more sustainable. It doesn't require an adaptation.
just on the design of the piles themselves. So we are seeing more information coming through where it's settlement reducing piles, for instance, rather than sort of conventional pile design work to the factors of safety. I don't know how many schemes, but I guess it's probably still well under 10%. But the fact that there is a movement in that direction is, I think, a really positive one from a sustainability point of view.
The thing I would sort of pitch in with here as well is that I know that AGS, BDA, and FPS have been very, very frustrated with the commissioning of ground investigation on projects. And we had a task group on this years ago that was sort of feeding into the new specification on ground investigation that, as I understand it, is still routinely ignored
so that you don't get enough borehole logs across the site. And for me, this is sort of part of the missing piece, because if you've got that data and it's being fed into the pile design, then you can do the optimization piece more accurately, much more accurately. And I think the sort of message to the industry, and to clients on this is that, well, you're saving a massive amount of cost by doing this, but you're also managing the risk in the ground far more carefully, because you know or have a much better picture of what's there. And once you've got that data, and that data feeds all the way through the project to the as-built repository at the end, then you know what's there into the future, which then opens up the possibility of pile reuse, which is, of course, the most sort of economical, circular, sustainable thing that you can do with these things, without wanting to do our members out of a job into the future. but I think there's a whole piece around that sort of connects back to what John was saying at the beginning around data and AI.
Yeah, so it's that the data piece. So I can come on to it. You've triggered a thought process, as you normally do, but if so, I'll come back to that, because interesting. You talk about pile reuse. There are sort of two activities. One is very good, and the other is very bad. One is pile reuse. The other is pile removal. And there has been a trend in recent years, and I don't have an answer to this. This is more an observation. And the trend has been, as buildings have got taller, for piles to get fewer in number, but much larger diameter and much deeper, they therefore become much more position critical. And anything in the way has to be removed. And the interesting thing is, if you stand, as I was yesterday, if you stand next to the gherkin and look around you at the buildings there, the gherkin is on a pretty lightweight foundation, really, when you consider when you look at the piled foundations beneath it, compared with the buildings next door and over the road and round the corner and the scalpel and whatever else. And the bigger the building, or the modern buildings nowadays, very often you find that there's complete intransigence with where you put piles. Whereas in fact, if you can be flexible, and you may end up having more piles, but a larger number of lighter loaded piles or whatever, that you can thread in between existing piles that may be redundant. And as Steve said, there are a number of jobs at the moment. There's one I can think of where a huge core has been exposed, and they've said, well, we don't really know necessarily who put them in. We don't really know how they're going to perform. But we do know they've had a 35-storey building on them for the last 40 years. So they must have a residual capacity of at least X. So we'll use them for 50% of the capacity of the new core. Now, that is a very enlightened approach. That's a brilliant approach. And whereas there are other projects where you go and they say, no, sorry, our new pile needs to be 4 metres longer than the one you've got there. So you must core it out. And you think, well, coming back to the noise, the damage, the carbon, the fuel, the dust, the whole thing. And then you're going to replace it with a pile that's got potentially, I don't know, 50, 60 cube of concrete down it. And you think, well, we've just cored out the equivalent volume. So I think reuse, which comes back to commercial issues, commercial risk, is who's got the data, who's got the records. And I'm of a vintage, as I always laugh when John says he doesn't feel very young. I'm of a vintage where I remember all records were paper. Then we went to microfiche, then we went to 5.5-inch floppy disk, then we went to 3.25-inch floppy disk, then we went to memory sticks, and so on, and now we're all in the cloud. And so what format and for how long companies have to store data and who owns it is going to become increasingly thorny into the future, because more and more data will be stored, and who actually owns it? Because there's an awful lot of work going on, an awful lot of design work at the moment, producing less sustainable foundations than are possible, because somebody either doesn't want to or can't get hold of the data that they actually require of the existing foundations. But removing piles, designing in the requirement to remove piles, is really very in urban environments as well. You just think, really, why are we still doing this? move them. A larger number of more lightly loaded piles are less position critical. And it's an interesting point because it does come down to data and the SA, the AGS, the SI stuff. Models will help, yes, and stress models will help, but there has to be a degree of standardization. Because in terms of instrumentation of piles, and I know there's been this dream for many years, you instrument the piles, you monitor how the pile is performing under the building's then demolished, you download the information in the pile, so that it will tell you what the capacity of the pile is, and away you go, you design another building and so on. And that's great, as long as you can get hold of the information in a format. If somebody now gave you a 5.5-inch floppy disk and said it's all on there, but where would you go? It's like giving somebody a beat-up experience.
Yeah.
All very useful. I don't know what's on it. And that plus the liability where, again, there's a bodies involved, responsible bodies involved are loath to share data and share information, partly because they think they're going to give someone else a competitive advantage. You think, well, no, that's my data. I'm holding on to that. You think, well, let's think that through. And again, I don't have an answer. But let's think that through because most commercial issues with the sharing of design information from previous projects, it doesn't really give you that great an advantage, but the benefit to the whole industry and the whole of society is so much.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree there, John. How many of us have time in our day-to-day lives to do a huge amount of data and analytics, even with our own data, let alone scooping everybody's and doing that? So I think it's hugely relevant, as you mentioned, in the monitoring of buildings, the monitoring of piles in situ. You know, it relates back again to your live load, dead load. You know, what did the pile actually see? We assume if we didn't have a factory of safety that half the pile would be loaded. But do we even see the safe working load? Does a safe working load, is it an actual load that will be witnessed one day? And it'd be really interesting, wouldn't it, when the wind comes from one of these storms that we're having more frequently. What is the wind load? Does the pile see what it's been designed to see? And, you know, monitoring, as you say, monitoring is going to create huge amounts of data. What we do with that is massive. But I totally agree that there is a degree of sensitivity and we need to be careful with how we do it. But that should not be a reason that we don't talk and think long and hard about how we do share for the wider benefit, because it's just blows the doors off what you could do.
I think that's it's an area I get the sense is an area of much head scratching at the moment, and there are sort of conservative commercial instincts at play there, understandably and quite legitimately at the moment. But I do think it's a big area of that's going to be discussed. And we've got there's a conference coming up next year in Bruges with the DFI and EFFC, where digitalization, sustainability are very big themes. And I'm working with Jason Boddy at ARUP to sort of try and shape the sort of digitization part of that. Might rope both of you Johns into that.
Feel free.
I think there's, because the actual whole contractual model around construction needs to evolve to a far more consultative, partner-based, collaborative model rather than the sort of, you know, pushing risk down the supply chain kind of model that tends to exist at the moment. Mm. We need to get to a far more collaborative space where actually people are far more open with sharing data in order to bring those benefits to the project. And I think people are getting their heads around, well, how do we do that? And how do we still, as businesses, make this commercially sustainable for ourselves? And I'd say one of the things that we're beginning to look at within the FPS is actually mapping all our projects for clients so that there'll be a single place that you can go to see who did the piling at a particular site, so that you know who to actually contact to get the data if you're looking to pile that, or if you're piling next door, you know, who's actually had experience of the ground conditions there and can actually give you a more realistic, optimized view of you know, what it's going to entail to do what you want to do. So you know, in a way there we're getting much smarter around it, and I think we're heading in the right direction, I hope, with having.
And the FPS sustainability group is still going strong. I suppose if for any members listening, just to encourage people to attend that group, because it's almost an open invitation, isn't it? Anybody that really wants to get involved can go.
Absolutely. We met on Wednesday this week, had a really great session, and we were looking at, well, what are the next things to do? So there have been a great series of guides produced between the EFFC and DFI, using a lot of FPS insight and insight from around Europe and the US on things like decarbonisation, the circular economy. There's a water guide coming up, a biodiversity guide, and one that I think will be really interesting, which is one on climate risks and opportunities. So looking at the role that we have to play as ground engineers in helping protect our infrastructure and our communities from you know, events like we're seeing in Florida at the moment, you know, where you're getting, and in Vienna, and in Germany in the last couple of years, where you've had sort of surge, you know, sort of flood surges that are causing widespread damage and disruption.
Yeah. So, great. And there's the group, the Sustainability by Design group that was happening within the FPS, has that been absorbed into the broader sustainability group?
That, funnily enough, actually sits under our technical committee. There's a little bit of a debate of, well, where should that actually live? There's a little bit of looking over the fence at each other, I think, on that, to be fair. But I think there's going to be some, we're looking at how we actually tie those two groups together a little bit more. I know that Dimitrios, who's leading that group, is, I think, approaching the end of his initial work thing, which is to look at power raft design. And now I think it's then getting him to and his team to look at pile design more widely, and sort of get into that, because that's actually he sort of started, I think, with a discrete part of it to get his head around the challenges there, which sort of represents, I don't know, probably what, 10% of the market maybe, and now getting him into the focused on the bigger piece, which I think will then you know, pay dividends to everybody who's in that space. But to go back to what John was saying, I think, you know, if you talk to Luke Diemer, who's been on this podcast before, he would absolutely endorse, he's the chair of the Sustainability Working Group for the EFFC, which is the Federation of Piling Federations in Europe, and the deputy chair of the FPS one. He always talks about that sort of carbon hierarchy of, you know, you start with, well, do you need this project at all? That's not our decision. And then you sort of work your way down through, you know, at various stages of optimizing what you're actually putting into the ground or thinking, how you're thinking about the ground in order to find the most sustainable solution. So, you know, that I think is quite a fundamental shift in mentality that the whole industry needs to take on board, and that's very much upstream from the piling contractor, I think, as John has suggested as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to keep reminding ourselves of how important the geotechnical industry is, because you say when we're talking about piling, we're normally talking about obviously building on poor ground or brownfield sites, and the very often we're working on a poor ground because the biggest development areas in this country are where the ancient Britons and the Romans put them. They're nearly all on rivers and estuaries and whatever else. And so buildings have been able to go up rather than out, courtesy of ground engineering, which is a far more sustainable way of building, is going up rather than out, or going down rather than out, and reusing brownfield sites and reuse. So we've talked about the some of the unsustainable approaches to not reusing piles or having to remove, but at least we're talking about the problem of reusing a site that's already been built on. We're not talking about building on greenfield sites or agricultural land and so on. And I would when you say about, do we need the development at all? It's interesting. It's quite a bigger philosophical thing. But going back to when we were talking before about the digital changes, and digital engineering and AI and so on, and does that change the skill set? I think it does, but I think it perhaps reinforces the most basic skill set of being an engineer, which is if something is counterintuitive or it looks wrong, it probably is. So challenge it. And at the moment, we're doing things that look wrong because the liability hierarchy requires us to do it. Whereas, in fact, the more we challenge things that look unsustainable, or, you know, somebody's built a very low-rise building or something, and it's got 1,200 diameter piles under it, or something, we'll challenge it. If it's on the drawing, back in the old days, when I was sort of turning out piling tenders for a living, to me, I just took the drawing as a guide. If it had 600 diameter piles in it, I'd look at the loads and see if I could make them smaller. And if you look at the loads, a lot of the factors of safety are in there now are a mix and a mismatch of concerns that designers had over various different factors, like how reliable was the concrete? Well, now, ready-mix concrete is incredibly reliable material, whereas 30 years ago, it was less reliable. Site batching was quite common. That was incredibly unreliable. Whereas now, you know, some of the things people are worried about have more or less dropped away, but they're still they haven't changed their design approach to absolute utter caution. And I would just urge, you know, and whatever age, whatever experience, being an engineer does involve questioning. It doesn't just involve following, you know, a set hierarchy of risk or whatever, and say, if you test the argument, look for something that if it doesn't look right, at least ask why, because it all helps with the sustainability. Say no where something is wrong. Say if it doesn't feel right.
This is a critical issue, and it's something that at the John Mitchell lecture in Berlin a couple of years ago, Maurice Bottio, who's general manager of Franke in Belgium, gave a really inspiring lecture on the role of the engineer and the contractor, the client, and basically brought us back to the principles that you know, fundamentally in this industry we're problem solvers, and that needs to be far more respected, I believe, by clients and consultants and others, and actually work with us to solve the problem and not actually treat us as we're going to give you the specifics of what we want you to put in the ground and just put it in the ground. Thank you very much. And do that, you know, treat us like a builder banging in a nail rather than somebody who really understands the intricacies of the project that we're being asked to do, and the difficulties and challenges within that. So
let's use our intelligence, let's use artificial intelligence, and I'm sure this industry will have a brighter, more sustainable future. John, Kieran, thanks for your time. Been really interesting chat today. I know John's published some of his John Hopkins published some of his material online already, so you'll be able to view the survey information and some of his research. I dare say there's a lot more to come, and keep an eye out for those sustainability by design pieces as well. So thanks so much. Till next time. Bye bye.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Steve. Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.